Here I am. Professor Richard Massey is with us, and he is a first-class astronomer. He had use of the Hubble telescope until it went on the fritz. It will be repaired, but in the meantime, if you've ever wanted to ask a question of somebody who's certainly used Hubble, or somebody who is constantly looking at the night sky, questions about all that you can see when you walk outside, this would be the man, Richard Massey. So pick up a phone and join us. We'll be right back. I must say, this has been very, very useful for me. I definitely understand a great deal more about the concept of dark matter than I have in any previous program. It's been very, very interesting, Professor, and I'm going to turn you over to the normal folks now and see what kind of questions they come up with. No guarantees.
See how it can help.
Let's see what happens. Let's go to Phil in South Carolina. You're on with Professor Massey.
Hi, Professor Massey. It's my honor to talk with you. My question is really two parts. I'm fascinated with comets, okay, ever since I saw Kohoutek and then Halley's. I'm 45 years old, and I guess when will be the next comet that we may see, at least here on the East Coast, with the naked eye or perhaps with binoculars? And my second question has to deal with the first. What do you recommend as far as a type of instrument to for the novice just to see stars in a non-light polluted area, the heavens and stars, planets? Like
you that. Mean what's a good telescope?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Professor. Comets, that's an interesting question. We had Hale-Bopp. Are there any comets you're aware of, Professor, that are going to really wow us in the reasonable future?
I have to confess, there's not any that I don't work on comets. They're all a bit too nearby for me. They're all very close to home. The one that came recently was tremendous in January, and yeah, I have to say I don't know what's coming next.
All right.
Halley obviously isn't going to be back for another 60 years or so.
All right. I guess we can always get surprised, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a surprise this one in January. It was quite as bright as it ended up being. That these things, particularly if they've never been seen before, quite close to the sun, when they get close to the sun and get their tail, then they often are a surprise as to exactly how bright they're going to appear. And this one, this most recent one, wasn't at all expected to be very astonishing or very very bright at all. It was really good to see it though.
And have you got a telescope at home, Professor?
I don't actually. That's
you don't.
One that I've never actually been into.
That's very interesting. In other words, there is no telescope you could run out and buy that would be in any way satisfy you.
Well, yeah, the ones in Hawaii, for a start, they're very big, and they're also in Hawaii.
Well, he was asking if I were to go out and buy a telescope, what would be a good one to get? And maybe you're not ready to answer that.
I'm not really ready to answer that, and but I mean, I don't know. They are tremendous, and I just don't know. I can't recommend a particular model. Sorry.
Well, I suppose once you've been with Hubble, why nothing else will do. All right, let's go to Blake in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Blake. You're on with the professor.
Oh yes, Professor Art. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, I noticed the practical application part of dark matter, how that it does exert energy. You can readily see it when you notice that there's frosted forms on the surface of a windshield or on the grass, and you notice that the weather isn't below freezing. That tells you the direct energy force coming from the deep recesses of space that is an antimatter, and it's actually slowing the electron movement and causing freezing to occur before the normal 32-degree weather temperature point. So looking at that dark matter band being, at an extreme distance, and our whole all the galaxies and universe we know encapsulated by this spherical black apparatus of exerting forces equidistantly on us, you can see how gravity actually pushes when two objects eclipse themselves. They have a vacuum zone between them, and the sum of all those vectors are pushing the objects together. So gravity actually really does push by virtue of dark matter. My concern is this project that is attempting to form a dark matter particle or a black hole, and not knowing the degree of energy that goes into these formations or is released in the collapse of these formations, seeing as dark matter repels dark matter and it attracts the mass of light matter, my concern is that it might impinge itself in the light matter physical makeup of our world and go into a continuous expanding state at an energy level that we can't comprehend and become a planet buster.
Okay. In other words, he's worried about the accelerator.
Right. So dark matter doesn't actually repel dark matter. It doesn't interact in any way with anything. One of the things that we've discovered is that dark matter doesn't interact in any way, even with itself. And so if we create it, then, well, we might create all sorts of things. But fortunately, Mother Nature has already done this experiment for us. You're worried about the energies created in this particle accelerator, that we're smashing things together at very high speed and creating dark matter, all sorts of things, even potentially very small black holes. But Mother Nature has already done this experiment. There are high-energy particles whizzing around the universe, and in fact slamming into the Earth's atmosphere every day, all the time. And we've already seen that these things have much higher energies than we're going to be able to create in this new particle accelerator, and that they don't create anything that's going to gobble the Earth. Fortunately, if they create dark matter, then it doesn't interact in any way, it just goes away. And even if they create a very small black hole, then those things, in fact, one of the things that Stephen Hawking has shown us is that those evaporate. Very small black holes evaporate. Mother Nature has already done this experiment and found out that actually nothing harmful is made. So when we reproduce it in the particle accelerators, we really don't need to be worried about that happening, because we've seen that it doesn't already.
Okay. And then he said something about the freezing, the condensation on his windshield when he's driving quickly. I think that has more to do with atmospherics than dark matter, yes?
Yes. When air is moving faster, it gets rarefied, it gets less dense, and then it can cool quicker.
Okay. John in Florida, you're on with Professor Richard Massey. Hi.
Hi.
Good evening. I had a question about harnessing the dark matter once you discover that it's really there. And if you were able to harness it, wouldn't travel to other places be almost instantaneous?
Wouldn't travel be almost instantaneous? I don't know how we would do that. I'd love to be able to teleport somewhere and travel somewhere instantaneously, but I don't think dark matter has any of the sort of required properties to be able to do that, unfortunately. And as Art said, I'm afraid that the sort of practical applications of using this aren't really very many. That this is a really exciting as a sort of curiosity thing to find out about the world around us. But in terms of practical applications, it doesn't do much. In fact,
of course, you never fully understand the possibilities of practical application until you understand what it is you have, right?
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, who knows what exactly it might be? And in particular, what theories of that? If that proves supersymmetric theory is correct, then we'll have a slightly different understanding about the way that physics works. And that might lead to all sorts of discoveries.
One never knows. Caller?
Applications always tend to be spin-offs from sort of pure blue sky science.
Right.
Do you think there's evidence on Earth now because of the pyramids that it had been harnessed by in the past?
I don't think the dark matter helped very much with the pyramids, I'm afraid. It would have just flown out of the pyramids rather than helping build them up together.
Though the pyramids certainly remain a mystery. How they were built remains a mystery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Bob in Pennsylvania, you're on with Professor Massey. Hello.
Yeah, it's an honor, Art, to be on your show. I have one question. Professor, do you believe in multiple universes?
Yeah. So, okay, Bob, that's a really good question. There might, in fact, be multiple universes. And this is one of the very interesting explanations of why we find ourselves in a universe that's so finely tuned to support life. And I said before that dark energy and dark matter are undergoing this tug of war to both fight out whether the universe gets bigger or gets smaller. And everything's just right that we find ourselves in just the right kind of universe that's lasted long enough to be able to have us evolve and observe it. Now, one of the explanations for this is this sort of really fine tuning, which is, you know, in itself kind of unlikely. One of the explanations for this is that we find ourselves in only one of very, very many universes, and those other universes might not necessarily be able to support life, but as is, and of course we find ourselves in one that is able to. And I find it a very compelling theory. The problem with it in terms of science is just that it's very difficult to prove. If you're trying to find things outside our universe, then how on earth do we look for them? And we haven't found a good way yet to prove that or not. So it's a really interesting theory, and I'm very excited by it, but I don't necessarily believe it one way or another yet.
Couldn't it be that dark matter would be able to move perhaps between dimensions?
One of these strange theories about what's going on in the universe is that there are actually different sheets or different sort of different universes.
Yes.
And that the dark matter, so, and these might be reasonably near to each other, but in some different dimension. And that dark matter is not actually dark matter at all. It's just ordinary matter on this different universe.
Exactly.
And gravity travels between this, between these two universes, and we see sort of a shadow or an echo of this ordinary matter, which we interpret as we see its gravitational effects because the gravity travels through the between the universes. But we don't see any matter there, and that's, you know, that's a really interesting idea about what the dark matter might be. But again, we haven't really got up to the point of proving any of that yet, so. It's still speculation at this stage, but really interesting stuff.
Okay. Somebody calling himself Rat Man in Hoagie Land. You're on with Professor Massey.
Good morning, guys. Yes, Hoagie Land is in South Philadelphia.
Okay.
And it's famous for its sandwiches.
Oh,
not
yes.
For being Richard Hoagland's cousin.
That's right.
But I'm fascinated by all this crossover between dark matter and black holes. And earlier, fortunately, someone had asked a question where tiny black holes had been brought up. And I was wondering if either Professor Hawking or someone else, Dr. Massey, has decided how small a sustainable black hole might be. And would we be able to detect it the way you're inferring dark matter currently?
Okay.
Hey,
how small could a sustainable black hole be?
Those hoagies are great. So the question is sort of, would we be able to see any of these small black holes? And in fact, we might be able to see small black holes or even dark matter if it sort of evaporates and turns into a shower of light in the form of gamma rays. And there is actually an experiment that's going to be launched soon, another satellite, called GLAST, I forget what it stands for, Gamma Rays Observation Space Telescope, something or other. We're very good at coming up with acronyms but not quite knowing what they stand for. But this thing is going to try and spot the decay of things like, of specifically dark matter, if it happens to eventually turn into light. And that might also find things like the showers of particles produced when black holes evaporate and fizzle away. So there are experiments underway to sort of test these things, but we haven't found any yet. We're still looking.
Well, I asked how small a sustainable black hole might be.
Oh, yeah, how small? There is a minimum mass needed for it. Black holes sort of live by feeding and slowly get more and more massive.
Exactly.
And as they get more massive, they, of course, attract more things to them. And then get more and more massive, and it runs away. All the time, they're sort of slowly evaporating, and it's only when they get particularly small that, below a certain threshold, which I can't remember, that they stop attracting matter to them at a sufficient rate that they will actually, the evaporation takes over, and they evaporate before they can eat some more material and get bigger. And so there is a cutoff, and it probably depends on the environment, but I can't remember off the top of my head what that is.
Well, that would be an important cutoff point, wouldn't it? In other words, if you created a black hole of sufficient size that it began feeding, you'd be in deep trouble, wouldn't you?
You would, yes. But these, I mean, if you're worried back about the particle accelerator, then the energies that yeah. we are going to reach in this particle accelerator are still below those that the energies of those particles that are slamming into the Earth's atmosphere all the time. So it really is not a worry that we're going to create anything big enough to start running away. Mm-hmm. You would need.
Hey, may I ask about a tie-in? Would a black hole eat dark matter?
Yes, it would. Completely. But the black hole pulls things in through its gravity, and dark matter does interact through the gravitational force. Things fall to it, and it falls to other things. So, yeah, dark matter will go into a black hole and increase its mass, just like any ordinary matter.
So wow. We could create black holes eventually, which could go out and eat dark matter and scoop new parts of the universe for the kind of matter one day if we ever expand that far.
Well, it's not really like clearing land, because we actually need dark matter around. Dark matter helps us grow. And in fact, there is dark matter around the solar system. It's not very concentrated. It's sort of spread out a bit. But there is dark matter around us now. And because it doesn't interact with us in any way, we don't notice its presence. It's very benign. It just helps create us and get us where we are. And it helps hold us together now. So we actually need it around. And we need this dark matter. We don't want to actually clear it up.
Yeah, without dark matter, if I understand what you said earlier, Professor, we wouldn't be held together. In other words, systems would move away at a very, very rapid rate from each other, and we'd soon be all alone, much sooner than otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, our whole galaxy would fly apart, because it's spinning so fast that if you took the dark matter away, it would just fly out in bits and splatter itself across the walls of the universe.
Fascinating. All right. Walt in Indiana, you're on with Professor Massey. Good morning.
Hi. You've sort of covered my question already, but I was going to ask if dark matter and energy could be clues to the existence of other dimensions, and you said that, yes, it could be multiple universes, the different sheets theory.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about this? Could dark matter...
dimensions.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Could dark matter perhaps be used to confirm the existence of other dimensions with gravitational measurements?
Yes, and because we don't know anything, well, we know scant details about it at the moment, we're basically piecing together the simplest possible theory that we live in the universe as we think and know it is around us, but there's extra dark matter. Well, as we find out more about dark matter, and particularly more about dark energy and the way that gravity works, as we sort of learn more about all these facts, we might find some flaws in this simple model. And this is how science has always gone throughout the ages, that you start with a simple model, assume the simplest thing, and then try to find flaws in it and try to find things that don't work, that the model predicts one thing but you observe another. And as we start observing more things, then that's the big hope, that we'll find some scientific revolution, and maybe one of these different theories of cosmology will explain things better than our simple picture at the moment.
Could I ask a follow-up?
You may, very quickly.
Just what you explained about something new being discovered. There's an astronomer, Halton Arp, who questioned the velocity component of redshift, which is what you guys use.
Hey, caller, listen, we're at a break point. I'm going to hold you over, all right?
Okay.
So just sit, rest, and we'll be right back to you. Professor Richard Massey is my guest. I'm Art Bell. Indeed so. My guest is Professor Richard Massey. He's had time on the Hubble telescope. He's an astronomer. And if you have a question that is in his area of concern, we'd very much appreciate it. We've got a caller online. We'll get back to him and the professor in a moment. Okay, Walt, thank you very much for hanging on. You're on the air once again with Professor Massey.
Thank you. We were talking about multiple universes and dimensions, and that's obviously very difficult to prove scientifically through replicable measurements. How come when somebody challenges something, particularly in a deep science like astronomy, and I mentioned this guy, Halton Arp, who questions redshift, which is the equivalent of Doppler for the universe, like how far away everything is, he seems to have come up with some proof that the velocity component of redshift isn't the only thing you should consider, that there's an inherent component. Do you know anything about that controversy? Because he was essentially, from what I understand, totally barred from time on any telescope. And the funny thing is, that's Hubble's law, I believe, the redshift thing. And he started out working for Hubble when he was alive. Do you know anything about that?
Right, yes. You're right. That's exactly what Hubble was designed to do. And what Hubble
no, I'm talking about Edwin Hubble, the astronomer. This
yeah,
guy
yeah.
worked with him. And he's challenged that quasars and redshifts and controversies, I think that was a book he wrote. Can you add any light? Because it seems that it's very difficult if you have something that's far out in science to get through to other people. They seem closed off. Your community of fellow astronomers say, well, look, there's questions about the Big Bang. I mean, I'm not sure. It logically, it just doesn't seem right to me. And I think people need to be more open to other ideas. And it seems like you guys crush any opposition to some idea that...
All right, well, let's stick with the redshift for a moment. It's
okay.
A very interesting question. Professor, there are challenges to redshift being a precise science for distance.
So I should leap to the defense of scientists a bit here. That we, of course, we do tend to be quite conservative just from the sort of nature that of the scientific method, that we really do demand quite strict
rightfully so
ideas. Right, yeah, and we're naturally skeptical about ideas. You're right, it's not always fair to immediately say something's wrong and not work on it further. And we perhaps do that a bit too much. But in terms of redshift now is really quite well set up as an estimate of distance. And there have been lots of new techniques, for example, things that the Hubble Space Telescope has done to really confirm that things that are further away from us really are redshifted. In other words, they just appear redder to us. And those techniques include things like these supernovae that we know that... are expected to be to all have the same intrinsic brightness. And sure enough, the ones that are redshifted do appear fainter as if they're further away from us. But then it's not just the one observational evidence or one bit of observational evidence that confirms this. There are other techniques, such as in this gravitational lensing that I work on, that galaxies which are more redshifted are also lensed but more, just because they're further away from us, and so there's more dark matter between them and us. And we can see that galaxies which are redshifted really are further away.
I agree with what you're saying, but it just seems to me that ARP may have found one out of 1,000 examples that doesn't agree with the whole redshift thing, and it would be a red flag to me that we better explain. He has... I think his best example was something called NGC 4319 and Markarian 205, two quasars, I guess, that he says that the way you astronomers, I'm not an astronomer, obviously, calculate these things doesn't take into account an inherent shift in the red that's caused by some of these quasars. They have galaxies and... NASA, there are a couple of other examples where NASA wipes these connections between a quasar and a galaxy out of the photograph because they can't explain it. And that's what bothers me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know.
ARP got totally thrown out of astronomy because...
All right, caller, let him respond. You said, do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't. And I don't think NASA really are in the habit of blanking out patches of the universe and sort of putting secret signs over certain portions of the sky. That we really are out there to try and understand what's going on. And you know, we honestly do have the best intentions to try and understand for ourselves. I mean, we become scientists because we're curious about these things. So we don't want to hide things away. And you're right that the way that we that progress is usually made is by finding things that don't fit the current picture, and therefore we have to go and rearrange the current picture. In terms of the sort of redshift of quasars in particular galaxies, we do know that just like a Doppler effect, if the sort of source, the quasar is moving, and it might well be moving within a galaxy, it might have its own velocity, then that does add to the redshift. That just as redshift can be caused by the universe expanding and also by things moving, just as we're all familiar with the Doppler shift of a passing police siren.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do know that that objects that are moving have their own redshift and therefore change the redshift distance relationship a little bit.
All right. John in Ohio, you're on with Professor Richard Massey.
Hello. I was wondering, you know how we got the atoms and then the protons and electrons and neutrons?
Yeah, sure.
That is the so-called smallest known object, the smallest thing we know so far?
In fact, there's even smaller things, that the protons and neutrons are made up of quarks, it seems. Each of them contains three quarks, which are even smaller particles.
Have we actually identified a quark yet, Professor? I thought we had not.
You can't see them on their own because they like to go around in threes. And so they naturally group together in threes. And we only end up seeing them in the form of triplets, some of which are protons, some of which are neutrons. And
okay, we haven't seen quarks yet. So otherwise, the smallest we've seen, he was
quark. Oh, okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my question was, is there any way possible that this dark matter could be a form of the smaller objects of atoms, protons, electrons, neutrons, before they were combined to create these, atoms that we know today?
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. And of course, this is the kind of thing that people first went out and started to investigate. We found this extra matter. Rather than inventing something completely new, let's just go through a checklist of things that we know are there, like the protons and neutrons, and see if they could possibly be the culprit. And so we went through, and it can't be protons, it turns out, because protons have an electric charge, so they would interact through the electromagnetic force. And that does things like it makes light scatter off a proton. So protons would emit and reflect light, so you'd be able to see them. So, and dark matter is completely invisible, so we can strike that off the list. So it's not protons. Neutrons, now, they're electrically neutral, so they don't interact via this force. But they would interact via gravity, so maybe it's them. But it turns out that a neutron, if it's on its own, is electrically neutral, but it decays, and it has after about 15 minutes, it turns out, any neutron that's on its own will turn into a proton and electron and also give off some light as well. So we'd eventually see those as well. So it can't be a neutron either. Now, there is another particle that it could have been, the neutrino, which is amongst the sort of known roster of particles in the standard zoo. And it could have been the neutrino. This is a very, very lightweight particle which whizzes around the universe at almost the speed of light. Mm-hmm. And it was thought for a while that it could perhaps be a neutrino. But again, we sort of went back to the observations and figured out what they would look like, or what we'd expect things to look like if dark matter were made of neutrinos. And it turns out that because it's so fast, it would whiz around the universe, basically smear out the structures, rather than seeing these fairly crisp, interconnected network of dark matter. It would see fuzzy blobs where the dark matter, if it were made of neutrinos, would have spread out and whizzed off in all sorts of directions at the speed of light. So it can't be the neutrinos either. And we've basically got to the point where we've run out of candidates of what it could be, and therefore started invoking different symmetries to come up with new particles and suggest that it's probably one of those.
What could it possibly be? The very, the smallest possible thing ever?
How about the quark? Since we haven't seen a quark yet, Professor, I guess we could speculate that they might be involved.
We could speculate, but then there are these really strong forces that try to get that try to get quarks to join together into these threes, and they even more rapidly than a neutrino turns into a proton and electron, these quarks would fall together and become protons and then start giving off light, and we'd see them. Okay. Everything we know basically interacts through the four forces that we know about, because this is sort of what physics is set up to. Physics has explained everything in these four forces, and these four forces are what causes things like light emission and shining. And so we have to find something that's really beyond this this theory to that doesn't interact via these four forces to explain the dark matter away.
Okay. Roger in California, you're on the air with Professor Massey. Hi.
Hi, Art. I love your work. I'm totally addicted to the show. And for your guest, Dr. Massey.
Okay, you're going to have to speak up good and loud. You're not too loud.
Okay. Hello, Richard.
Hi.
The exciting point I heard tonight was about the dark matter filaments forming a scaffolding or skeleton for the formation of ordinary baryonic matter. And there was the ancient Indian text, Hindu text, talked about a god who at the beginning of time cast a net out which covered the whole universe and which still is here.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if you cosmologists are getting your talking points from these ancient texts.
That's a really good analogy. Oh, great. What text is that? That sounds very interesting.
You know, I can't give you a quote right now or a site right now, but I read about it recently again in The Divine Matrix by Greg Braden.
Sounds a little like scaffolding, huh?
Yeah, a net is an analogy we use all the time. So that it's amazing, these engines. They really did get a load of things. They're very well described, didn't they?
Well, so that's interesting. It could be. Who knows? Jody in Texas, you're on with Professor Massey. Hi.
Yes, you're talking to me, sir.
I am.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question for the professor.
Hi.
And my question is, if dark matter is invisible and you really can't measure it, how did you come up with the figure that there's six times more dark matter than matter?
Okay, so that's from basically doing a budget or trying to account for the effects of gravity in the universe. So we know that wherever there's mass, there's some gravity, and wherever there's gravity, there's some mass.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at these spinning galaxies, for example. We can look on lots of different scales, and it still works out as about six times. But let's just look at the spinning galaxies. And we worked out how fast they were spinning, and so therefore sort of how much gravity is needed to hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
But then we sort of looked at the stars, and this was first done in the 70s. Look at the stars, count up how much mass you can see, and it just from there, we can count up all the stars that we can see and that we can, you know, that are out of this normal visible matter, and there just wasn't as much mass as we would need to create that gravity. To create the gravity that's needed to hold the galaxies together and keep them together while they spin relatively fast, we would have needed six times more mass than there is in the visible stars. So it's really just a budget exercise that we've counted up how much gravity there is, subtracted off the amount of gravity that's produced by the stars that we can see, but we're still left with a deficit that we've got something to make up, and that something is about six times as much as the gravity that we can see.
Okay. Mark in Tahoe, you're on with Professor Massey.
Great weekend of programming, Art. Thank you.
Thank you.
Doctor, I wanted to ask, has the cosmology community considered that the universe may be of a static size and everything within it, including time, is shrinking?
Including time is shrinking. So the idea that the universe is a static size was a perennial favorite until the sort of 40s. That in fact, the institute where I did my PhD was racked by a personal feud between two people who just couldn't agree on this issue about whether the universe was static or expanding. They got so angry with each other, they ended up forming their own departments opposite the road from each other. So it really has divided astronomy. Now, in recent years, everything really is coming together, and it's this idea of explaining lots of observational evidence in one theory that has really made everyone believe that the universe is indeed expanding. For example, we see we see the afterglow of the cosmic microwave background radiation. We see the afterglow of the initial fireball that created the universe, and so that implies that the universe used to be hot. By the fact that we see galaxies expanding around us, we know that if we run that backwards, the universe used to be small as well. So this is how we sort of form this scenario of the universe being having started at a hot, small condition and now expanding. And everybody basically now agrees on this scenario, to the point, in fact, that I think next year these two different halves of the institute in Cambridge, where I did my PhD, are actually moving back together and really joining back together. It was actually helped by an American donation that got these two people back together. Everyone's friends again, and we really do now all agree that that the universe really is expanding, and it explains so many things that it has to be true.
Well, it has to be true if the two departments are coming back together.
Oh, well, there you go. Yes, you see.
And if I can just make one other comment, we could use whoever's prayers up here in Tahoe. We've lost 165 homes and 2,000 acres to a wildfire tonight.
Yes, I've seen it on the news.
Indeed.
And indeed, the prayers go to you. Kimberly in Oregon, you're on with Professor Massey.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hello.
My question was with regard about the bullet cluster, fender bender, as you put it. Oh, I was wondering, applying our law of physics as we know it, and considering the different attributes of dark matter versus dark energy, as you explained them, looking at the unexpected behavior of the dark matter after the impact, is there any possibility that the dark matter was converted to dark energy?
Hmm.
Ooh. Well, we still see the dark matter, is the thing. We still, in the bullet cluster, we see this a lot of extra mass or a lot of invisible mass in a different place, crucially, to the ordinary mass. But we still see it, and it's still there. It's just because it's dark matter, it passed through itself and carried on, and it's now a long way away from the point of impact. But it's still there.
Have you detected any slowing? Have you detected any slowing of the dark matter, any movement, even a hint of movement back toward the larger mass?
Well, it will eventually slow down and fall back in naturally, just because it's affected by gravity. What we're actually doing at the moment is measuring if it has slowed down at all by the collision. Then we'd like to know about that, because that will say either it doesn't interact at all, and it just kept going, and it went at the same speed until it eventually slows down. Because
Professor, you know what? The show's over. I could go on with this. I, for example, would wonder if it could actually get escape velocity and keep going, but that's for another program. Listen, thank you so very much for being here tonight, and we'll do it again one time.
Oh, yeah, that was my pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Have a great night, Professor. That's it, folks. I'm Art Bell. See you next weekend.